this: Israel's suffering in Egypt. Now, that's a huge change of pace from one side of the page to the other, right? You end Genesis and it's like they have the best land, the people are like, they're blessed, they're healthy, and then Exodus 1:1. Now the names of the children of Israel who came to Egypt, each man in his household, came to Jacob. You get a listing, verse 7, but the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph, and he said to his people, look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply and it happen in the event of the war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land. Therefore they set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens, and they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage and mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All of their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one of them was Shipharath, and the name of the other was Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrews' women, and you see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. But the midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt had commanded, but saved the male children alive. So the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, why have you done this thing and saved the male children alive? And the midwives said to Pharaoh, because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are lively and give birth before the midwives come to them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and grew very mighty. And so it was because the midwives feared God that he provided households for them. So Pharaoh commanded all of his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. Okay, so chapter 1 of Exodus starts off with the nation of Egypt coming up with a way to control the population of the people of Israel. So the first idea was just to tell the midwives to kill the babies so they didn't know it was stillborn. It just died. Sorry about that. That didn't work. And so, okay, now when they have male children, you're going to pick up the child, you're going to go throw it in the river. You're going to kill these male children. The nation of Israel is working hard. They're slaves. But God is still multiplying them. Now we come to chapter 2, verse 1. And a man of the house of Levi went and took as a wife a daughter of Levi. So the woman conceived and bore a son. When she saw that he was a beautiful child, she hid him 3 months. Now, remember the story that we're into of Moses. They are to kill all of the male children. Okay, so they can't just walk around and be like, look, I have a baby boy. All right, so for 3 months, she hides them. And now we're in the process of when we become introduced to the rest of the characters of the story. Chapter 2, verse 3. But when she could no longer hide him, she took an ark of bulrushes for him and dabbed it with asphalt and pitch and put the child in it and laid it by the reeds in the riverbank. And his sister stood afar off to know what would be done to him. Okay, so we are now introduced to the story of Miriam. Her story begins watching out for Moses to see what would happen to him. Now, we know the end of this story, so we instantly recognize kind of the good thing God is going to do through this. But she has no way of knowing that this is going to be a happy story. See, the Egyptians, if they were to walk upon a baby boy of the Hebrews, they are to do what? Throw him in the river and kill him. Where is Moses? In the river. Right? So they have put the baby in this little basket of bulrushes, and they've made it so it's not going to sink, and they've put it into the side of the, so somebody will find him. But listen, if a normal Egyptian found him, they're going to like, look, it's a Hebrew baby. Throw him in the water. That's what the Pharaoh said to do. Who is the one who's supposed to watch this happen? Moses' sister. Now we read this and we go, wow, Miriam was so great because she was able to go and get her mom, and it's like, but Miriam didn't know that was going to happen. She's just there to see what happens to Moses. And we know the story of the princess. She comes down and Pharaoh's daughter looks and she sees the Hebrew baby and she's like, this is great. Like, and so we need someone to take care of the baby. And so Miriam runs in and says, I know a person. Let me go fetch her. And so Moses is now going to get to be raised by his family. But let's back up into Miriam's thoughts, because I think this is kind of, for me, where the story starts to get interesting. Moses, obviously, at this point in the story, he's been saved by Pharaoh himself, Pharaoh's family. If you're Miriam, if you're his family, you obviously can tell that God is going to do something with Moses' life. God has spared Moses for a reason. Josephus, a Hebrew historian, when he talks about this, he says that Miriam's father pleaded with the Lord to rescue the Hebrew people from the oppression they suffered in Egypt, and that he prayed to God to send a deliverer before Moses was born. So if you're Miriam, you've heard your dad pray for this. You've seen Moses delivered from the bulrushes. And then think about how long of a pause happens in the story. Have you ever felt like in your walk with God that God was about to do something great? You didn't know what it was. You didn't know how he was going to do it. But you just kind of sensed it. Like, man, we're like right on the precipice. We're right there. God's about to do something great. And then it just kind of stays there. It's like when you're a kid and Christmas morning is coming up. And you wake up at like 2 in the morning. You look at the clock. Like, oh, I can't get out of bed yet, right? And then you close your eyes, you look at the clock, it's 2:01, right? You're like, okay, close my eyes. And you count, you're like, it's gotta be like at least 5 in the morning, 2:03 in the morning, right? And you just can't wait, but it seems like time's not going anywhere. Imagine Miriam here for a minute. Moses is gonna grow up, he's gonna go live with Pharaoh's household, all of the story that goes into that. He's gonna go to the wilderness. 40 years. 40 years. This isn't like he took a weekend vacation and came back. If you're Miriam, you think and know that God is going to do something great, and then all of a sudden, hold on a second. 40 years. Not, the text doesn't tell us, but you would think that Moses probably didn't come back for family vacations to Egypt, considering that they wanted to kill him. So I'm assuming he didn't come home for, you know, holidays. You have the family that just has to wait and wait and wait. Having this heart that says God's going to do something great, but they just don't see it. They don't see how it's going to work, because you kind of, humanly speaking, you kind of had this thing figured out, right? Okay, so how is Moses going to deliver us from Egypt? Oh, he's in Pharaoh's household now. This is it. He is now the son of Pharaoh's daughter. In our simple terms, he's in the line to the throne. So all we have to do is just be patient. When the people above him die off, voila, we're in. Now Moses is Pharaoh, and he can be like, Israelites, you just go do your thing, right? This is it. And then one day you're at home, and you're Miriam, and you hear news. Moses has fled. Moses has a temper issue, and he got mad at an Egyptian, and he killed him, and he buried him in the sand, and he thought no one knew about it. And then the other guy's like, what are you going to do? You're going to kill us like you did the Egyptians? So he's like, now everybody knows. And so he fled. And so all of a sudden you're like, that whole plan we had worked out, that whole Moses deliver us, gone. And then nothing. As we walk through the story of Miriam's life, as she's watching all of these events unfold, as she got to be around Moses, probably until he was 9, 10 years old, some say maybe even up to 12, she was part of watching him learn and grow and being a part of his life, things that would shape his life. So much so that Hebrews 11, 24 and 25 says that he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to suffer affliction with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin. Everything about the story shows that Moses had been well taught, even at a young age. So many things that Moses would have learned and watched for. But Miriam just had to wait. All of the process of growth and all of the interesting details that we talk about on Moses' side of the story, all of the fascinating things that Moses must have got to see and to learn how to do when he was in Pharaoh's household. Not Miriam. She was still a slave. She was still, as the text reminds us in chapter 1, everything was done with rigor. They made it as hard as possible. Everything that the Israelites, the Hebrews, had to do was difficult. So as Moses leaves and he goes on to live in Pharaoh's household and enjoy all the things of Pharaoh's household, as he's growing, as he's experiencing all of these things, Miriam's not. She's just waiting for deliverance. She's just waiting and waiting and waiting. When you get to verse 11 through 14, Moses has now killed the Egyptian. Verse 14, what he said, when you have made us prince and judge over us, do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian? It's interesting that the Jews, the Hebrews, did not want Moses to be their leader. Now, I have no idea why. The text doesn't tell us why. Maybe they were envious because he's in the palace doing things, whatever, I don't know. But they basically, who made you judge over us? Who made you to be in charge? And we're going to get to this later. But it's interesting to note, remember when Aaron and Miriam kind of rise up against Moses? And God says to them, when I speak to people, I speak to them in dreams and visions. But when I speak to Moses, I speak to him face to face. And in plain speech. So he literally says to them, listen, I chose this guy, and I talked to this guy. And I'm not talking to you, I'm talking to him, right? He makes it very, very clear that he has chosen Moses, right? But the nation of Israel, the people, the Hebrews who were slaves, they weren't really interested in Moses. When Moses comes back to lead the people out of Egypt, they're not excited. They're not like, yay, our rescuer's here. They're like, oh, that guy again. They're not impressed. Now, if you're Miriam, once again, you're like, wait a second, Lord. You spared Moses. You put Moses in this situation. You provided all of this opportunity and all of these things. But it's like you're wasting it. It's almost like all of this stuff is a waste of time because it wasn't how God was going to deliver the people of Israel. Now, Miriam's not going to know it just yet. She'll figure it out as the story progresses. But the reason why God wouldn't let this be the way the people of Israel were delivered was because then they could have said, Moses is the one who brought us out of Egypt. See, what's going to happen in the story is God's going to make it so clear that only God was the one who brought them out of Egypt. It wasn't Moses. It wasn't Aaron. It wasn't somehow that they let everybody else above them die off and Moses got to be in charge. So all of a sudden Moses is like, yeah, you want to be free? I can do that for you. No, this was something that God wanted to do for the people, and he wanted it to be shown that only God could do this. Moses is 40 years old when he flees into the wilderness. If you're his family, you have waited for God to deliver your people, we'll make it simple, for at least 40 years. 40 years of oppression, more really, because Moses wasn't the first baby born. But at least 40 years they've been waiting for God to deliver, and then Moses is gone. And they wait another 40 years. I won't have any of you raise your hand, but if someone's 80 years old tonight, your whole life, guess how long Miriam had waited for God to deliver their people. This is a long time to wait. I mean, you think it's hard sometimes to wait for, like, oh, I have to do something like this afternoon. I chuckle when people come by my office and they have something to do like in 2 weeks. And like, well, I was just in town, so I decided I would get it done. You know? Like, okay. Like, you have like 2 weeks. We want to get things going. We go to a fast food restaurant, and if it takes more than like 2 minutes to get our food, we're like, this is forever. And here's Moses' family for 80 years. As I get to this point in the story, this is to me where God is reminding us that his timetable and our timetable are not the same. God is not bound by human years. He's not bound as we think of time and minutes and days. His plan is infinitely more well thought through than we can imagine. And so here's Moses. He goes to the wilderness for 40 years. And then he comes back. Now, I have a pretty good imagination. But I can imagine being there. And then people start talking. Do you know who's here? Moses. And Miriam's like, who? Who'd you say was here? Moses. He's going to talk to Pharaoh. And they're like, he's back? He's alive? Oh, he's married with a family. That's fascinating, right? He comes back. He goes to Pharaoh and he says, let my people go. And then throws down a stick and it turns into a snake. And then the snake eats all the other, you know, sorcerers' snakes. Which is crazy, by the way, to think about. The power of Satan to duplicate what God did was not lost on Pharaoh, right? So they threw down their staffs and they turned into snakes, and then Moses ate all of them. Then he picked it back up. Moses puts his hand into his coat and he pulls it out. It's leprous, and he puts it back in and it goes away. They could reproduce the leprosy, but they couldn't clear it, right? And then all of a sudden there's 10 plagues going through the things that happen. You think about all of the crazy things that happen. And if you're Miriam, you're like, we're going to get to go. Miriam would have participated in the first Passover. They would have brought in the Paschal lamb. They would have eaten dinner standing. They would have put the blood over their doorpost. And the whole time, you can almost sense the anticipation in the house. Because unlike everybody else who's just now getting excited about going, they've been waiting 80 years for this. This excitement is real to them. It's difficult to imagine how emotional this time would have been for the people of Israel. We can't really fathom this. But the best image that comes to my mind when I think about this is that young guy who was a guard for North Korea, who got shot 5 times while running across the border for freedom. His life was so harsh, so bad, that he was willing to run past bullets for freedom. And you look at that and you go, yeah, we don't really quite understand that emotional drive. We don't understand that passion for something we don't have. But Moses' family did. As they went under all of the weight and the pressure of the Egyptian rulers who were trying to destroy their people. And God kept multiplying them. They had to wait. As they begin to exit, flip to Exodus 12:41. We are given a quick little synopsis, if you will. Go back to verse 40. Now the sojourn of the children of Israel who lived in Egypt was 430 years. And it came to pass at the end of 430 years, on that very same day, it came to pass all the armies of the Lord went out from the land of Egypt. It is a night of solemn observance to the Lord for bringing them out of the land of Egypt. This is the night of the Lord, a solemn observance for all the children of Israel throughout their generations. 430 years of waiting. 430 years of asking God to do something and just waiting for an answer. You say, well, how do you know they're waiting for 430 years? Do you remember Jacob is about to die? He says, listen, when I die, I don't want to be buried here. I want to go home. This whole part of Israel's history in Egypt was just God providing for them and setting them up to leave. Now, they leave as slaves, but as they leave, the nation of Egypt is so happy to see them go. They're like, listen, let's throw you a party. You want some jewelry? You want some gold? The nation of Egypt is going to bestow on them so much earthly possessions that when Aaron makes the golden calf, he only asks for earrings. Have you just stopped and considered how many earrings you would have to give to make a golden calf? You could be like, oh, I've got one. Right? Now, the nation of Israel is huge. There's 800,000 men, so about 2 million people, men, women, and children who leave. Okay? So this is not like a small little huddle of people going out into the wilderness. This is 2 million people. But they have enough in their possessions that when they give their earrings, Aaron can make a golden calf. Now, the golden calf wasn't small. Like, it wasn't like, you know, a little figurine that he could put on. Like, 2 million people have to see something fairly large to see it. So this is how much God is going to bless the nation of Israel with as they leave Egypt. All of that happens because he wants to make a point. Just like when they came to Egypt, Joseph says, you meant it for evil, but God meant it for good. As they leave Egypt, say, listen, the nation of Egypt meant this for evil, but God meant it for good. Now, 430 years of Israel's history tells us they are not quick learners. The same thing that they didn't wait for God over and over and over in the story of Israel keeps showing up. Now, I'm one of those people that I read that and I'm encouraged Maybe you read it and you think, man, those Israelites, they're stubborn, slow people. I read it and I go, that's encouraging, because I tend to be one of these slow, stubborn people. And so I'm gracious and grateful that as I look at this, that God's saying, listen, I'm going to keep teaching the same lesson over and over and over again. Because as I read the nation of Israel, I'm like, man, they didn't figure it out. Because they're going to get to the mountain, they're supposed to listen to God, and they send Moses up instead, and then they start worshiping a false god. He sends manna, and they're not happy with manna. He sends manna and quail, and they're not happy. Everything they do, they get to the promised land, they send in the two spies, they're not happy. They're never content with what God is sending them. They've waited 430 years for this thing. And when they get it, what's their first response? Moses, you brought us in the wilderness to die. I think I was like 9 years old. And I don't remember even what the toy was now. It'd be a funnier story if I remember what the toy was, but I wanted this toy really, really bad. And my mom and dad had bought it for me for Christmas. And when I unwrapped it, it was like super, super exciting, right? It's the thing that you want, rip it open. And I was so excited to get it out of the box that, you know, those little wires that tie it into the box? When I pulled the toy out, the wire stayed and the toy broke. And so it was like pinnacle of life, Death Valley, right? You know, like, and so you're like, best toy, best day, worst day, right? And the thing that I wanted so badly because of my lack of patience became the thing that was intensely depressing to me, right? This is the nation of Israel, by the way. We want freedom. And then they get it. And then they're like, oh, here comes the Egyptians. We're all going to die. Thanks, Moses. We could have just died in Egypt, right? Instantly, they go from, this is what we want, to, you just brought us out to die. Imagine if you're Miriam. Imagine if you have just watched the 10 plagues. You've watched the Passover celebration for the first time in your family. You have walked with the people past the city gates, past the borders of Egypt. Your heart is thrilled by the greatness of who God is and what He has done to free your people. And then you start to hear everyone around you say about your brother, you brought us out here to die. Imagine what she's thinking. Imagine the emotional conflict that's going on in her life. Because like everyone else, she too sees the cloud of dust, nation of Egypt coming after them in their chariots. I think sometimes when we read through these stories, we forget the emotional toil and struggle that the characters of the Bible go through. It's not that we sanitize the story, but we remove the personal difficulties from the characters. But everything that she has gone through, the struggles in which she has wrestled through, the truths about God she has fought through in her mind, are going to show up in her life. These are lessons that God has taught her over 80 plus years. When we think of characters in the Bible, they're real. They're real people. And next week, we're going to get to the second half of the story, the deliverance of the nation of Israel from Egypt, and then really Miriam's response to this and a role that God is going to give her, and then some things that she needs to learn about God. But I want us to understand from the outset of the story that there's a lot of emotional connection to Miriam in the story of Moses. And a lot of times we look at the stories and things in the Bible and we skim over them. But these are stories that are teaching us things about ourselves. Because you may not relate to the Apostle Paul. You may not be like, wow, I was a super gifted student who memorized the first five books of the Bible and was like really, really smart. That may not be you. You may not read that and go, yeah, I can relate to that. But you can relate to Miriam, who had to wait for God, because we've all had to do that. We've all had to sit there and God say, no, 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 not yet. Just wait. Ever traveled with kids? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Imagine Miriam having this conversation with God. Are we there yet? Are we there yet? Moses is 40 years old. Are we there yet? Now. Yeah, now. Good, now. And he disappears. Oh, guess we're not going to get there. Moses shows back up. Now, now, now. She's had to wait on God. Let me just encourage you tonight, if you have to wait on God, he is trustworthy to be waited upon. You can have confidence that God's will never gets thwarted. So if God has put you in a position in your life like Miriam where you just have to wait, then wait with confidence because God will keep his word. Next week, we're going to talk about what happens when good things happen, and what happens when we make bad decisions. We're going to look at two things in Miriam's life. One, she made a really good decision, and one, she makes a really bad decision. But once again, it's a good example to us. We will never be perfect. Even when you make amazing decisions, you will still make stupid ones. And it's how we respond to those decisions, both good and bad, that explain to the world around us our faith. It demonstrates to us a genuine belief in who Christ is when we can look at our mistakes and go, listen, I can still follow God even after I've made a mistake. If you're waiting on God, be confident because God is worthy to be trusted.